So he was born on the 21st of May, 1991. He did his PhD with Umesh Vasirani at the University of California, Berkeley. He did postdocs at the Institute for Advanced Studies and also here in Waterloo, you're actually at IQC. Then after receiving a number of competitive offers, he took a faculty position at a place called MIT in America. So he's known for lots of things. He is a founder of the Complexity Zoo, which as of this morning had 489 classes. These are classes in computer science, complexity classes. He was also involved in an intellectual property issue, scandal, I'm not sure what it is, which was interesting. The end result of that was a settlement was made, and the company in question made a charitable contribution to two scientific organizations that anyway, Scott is a very broad person. He's a computer scientist by training, but interacts with physicists in a broad range of disciplines. And today he's going to speak on quantum money.
Yep. All right. Thanks a lot, Lucian. Incidentally, the passage that was plagiarized was about if quantum mechanics is not about waves or particles, then what is it about? Well, it's a theory of information, probabilities, and observables, and how they relate to each other. And this was put in the voice of two supermodels in a bar in a Ricoh printer commercial. It was really the silliness, I think, that got to me. I thought that maybe that would resonate at PI. So it was actually based on lecture notes from a course that I gave over at IQC. It was some kind of honor. And that's actually the main thing on my Wikipedia page now. That's okay, fine. But I wanted to. So it's always great to be back here in Waterloo. So I wanted to tell you about not my main research interest, but sort of a fun side project that I've been working on for a few years, together with some other people. Apologize, I forgot to change that to a Canadian bill on that electron or whatever it is. And I'll tell you what, I'll say Z. Okay, maybe that will make up for it. So what's my starting point? Ever since there's been money, there have been people trying to counterfeit it. This is one of the oldest security problems facing human civilization. So you could say this is like a 3,000-year-old or longer, open problem. I'm sure there were, people taking, purple seashells from the beach or something that were supposed to, be the unit of currency and trying to get counterfeit money. So it's something that has to be solved reasonably well before a market economy becomes possible. It has a long distinguished history even within physics. So some of you might know that in his capacity as a master of the mint, his post-physics career, Isaac Newton, worked a lot on making English coins harder to counterfeit. He also personally oversaw the hangings of quite a few counterfeiters, which is another solution to this problem, and not one that we're going to be pursuing in this talk, but as academics, we're sort of limited in our power, and today we have all sorts of other approaches to making money harder to counterfeit, depending on which country you're in, you know, your money will have holograms, embedded strips, special inks that look different depending on the angle, right? And if you see like someone in a convenience store holding the bill up to the light, then they're checking for these sorts of things. But it's sort of obvious that all of these things, you know, lead to an arms race with no obvious winner, right? As mints get more sophisticated, well, counterfeiters also get more sophisticated, right? And the technology improves on both sides. Okay, so you know, so if we want to just step back and look at what's going on from sort of a fundamental perspective, from a computer science perspective, it just seems completely impossible for trivial reasons to have uncopyable money, because you know any printing technology that a government could build, the bad guys could in principle build as well. Okay, and you know indeed that's what happens that. After some lag time, right, that counterfeiters will just copy whatever the mint is doing. If we want to sort of take an even more theoretical perspective, the function that takes a string x and maps it to two copies of x happens to be implementable in polynomial time. You can take classical information can be copied. Okay, you can take a string of bits and you can run off as many more copies of that string as you like. All of the existing solutions rely on somehow, hiding the string of bits that corresponds to your dollar bill, right? Encoding it in a hologram or whatever. But if you can read all of those bits, then you can copy them. Okay. So what is it that's done in practice today? Well, what we do is we just have a trusted third party, like the bank, authorize every transaction. These are some services that some of you may have used, that rely on the trusted third party solution. Okay, you may have also gotten emails purporting to be from some of these services, right? So, of course, the problem with having a trusted third party is that you have to trust that party. Right. Well, that's one of the problems. This is what's done for this is how we're able to have electronic commerce and buy and sell things over the internet. There are some cases where we want the convenience, privacy, and anonymity of cash. So, for example, if you're a drug dealer, if you're a former governor of New York, there are all sorts of situations where you would like to have a transaction without any trusted third party intermediating. Okay, and it seems that we can't get everything that we want, right? You can't have cash which is cryptographically secure because you could always take whatever information is used to encode the bill and just use it to make more copies of the bill. Okay, and indeed this is correct in classical physics, ... Okay, so, all right, so now what we do is we shift from Newton to Heisenberg. Newton in both his physics career and his career as master of the mint didn't know about is, of course, the uncertainty principle, which is that, there are objects in the physical universe that encode some information, but you don't get to read out all of that information. Okay, you get to make a choice as to what information you want. So for example, you can measure a particle's position or its momentum, but not both to unlimited precision. And actually, a logical consequence of the uncertainty principle is what we know as the no cloning theorem, that there's no general procedure that takes an unknown quantum state psi and that produces as output two copies of psi, two unentangled copies. And one way to see this is it's just like a line of algebra that that this would be a nonlinear operation, right? Which would break quantum mechanical linearity. Although sort of obvious as it is, it apparently took people sort of many decades to really understand this. Another way to say it is that if there were a way to clone particles, then you could violate the uncertainty principle, right? You could measure the position of one of the copies, you could measure the momentum of the other one, and then you would learn both to a greater precision than it is allowed by the uncertainty principle. Okay, so this leads to what's probably the first idea in the history of quantum information. So Stephen Wiesner was a physics graduate student in Columbia in 1969, Columbia, New York, wrote a paper pointing out that quantum mechanics, in principle, creates the possibility of money which is physically impossible to counterfeit. Okay, and this was actually the same paper where he first sort of raised the idea of quantum cryptography, what later became like a quantum key distribution was sort of rediscovered by Bennett and Broussard and others like 15 years later. So Wiesner was actually unable to publish this paper anywhere. It eventually ended up in SIGAC News, which is sort of our sort of little rag or our sort of house journal of, our sort of announcements publication of theoretical computer science. And apparently he's now herding goats in the Negev desert. So good idea, don't be too far ahead of your time. But all right, but what was Wiesner's proposal in this paper, which, you can go back and read it, and it's pretty amazing. It really has, a lot of the ideas that we think of as much later, and they're just, they're right there. So, you can get it on the web. What's it called? It's called conjugate coding. It's, there's like a PDF on the web. So, so now the idea is that each bill, $20 bill that's handed out will include a few hundred qubits, which, as usual, we don't really care exactly what they are. They could be photons, there could be electrons. And, obviously, if you're keeping this thing in your wallet, there's a bit of a technological problem here in terms of keeping these things coherent for, more than a few microseconds or whatever. But we're going to ignore that for the time being. Okay, we're going to assume that, we're in the far future. We can not only build quantum computers, but we can even miniaturize them to the size of a wallet. And, we can, everyone can walk around with qubits that, that stay coherent for a long time. I mean, you don't even need the, most of the power of quantum computing for this. You just need sort of individual qubits, which should be kept coherent. So each bill will include, let's say, a few hundred electrons, and they'll have been secretly polarized by the bank in one of four random directions. So here, think of these as like 0, 1, 0 plus 1 over root 2, 0 minus 1 over root 2. Okay, these are also the four states that arise in quantum key distribution. So, and now in a giant, ordinary classical database, the bank is going to remember how it polarized every electron on every bill. Okay, so it'll remember the quantum state that's associated to each bill. Okay, each bill will also have a conventional serial number. Okay, so along with that serial number, it'll will be the corresponding electron state. And now, okay, let's say you want to verify that a bill is genuine. Then what you do is you take it to the bank, and now the bank will use its knowledge of the polarizations for each bill, which it has in its classical database, in order to measure each electron in the appropriate basis. If the state is 0 or 1, then it measures in that basis. If the state is plus or minus, then it measures in the plus minus basis. Okay. Because it knows it can measure and make sure that the thing is correct. Now the crucial theorem, Wiesner didn't actually fully prove in his paper, but it was proved later, is that a counterfeiter who doesn't know the state of a bill can copy it only with a success probability that decreases exponentially with the number of electrons. Okay, so of course there's a chance that you could just guess what the state is and be right, but that chance decreases exponentially with each qubit that you add. Okay, and you can do a little bit better than the obvious strategy, but not that much better. Okay, you can succeed with probability like 5/6 to the n, where here n is the number of qubits per bill. Okay, and intuitively this is just because, if you don't know whether a given qubit was prepared in the 0-1 state or the plus-minus state, then there's a very good chance that the measurement you would make to determine it is going to destroy the qubit, right? So, yeah.
Single qubit operations. This
five. Oh no! This is allowing arbitrary, including arbitrary entangled operations. That's a good question. Thanks. So it's an information theoretic result. It says no matter what you know, quantum operation, whatever, no matter what super operator you perform on the combined state of all the qubits, you're only going to have this success probability in, with the copy. Okay? All right. So what are the drawbacks of Wiesner's scheme? Well, there are a few. You know, one we already mentioned, you need to somehow keep the bills from decohering in your wallet. All right, we're going to ignore that for this talk. The second one is, you know, sort of a practical problem. The bank needs to maintain this giant database of polarizations that stores for every possible serial number, right? What is the quantum state corresponding to that? Okay, there's actually a solution to that, which was pointed out in a later paper, you know, also far ahead of its time, by Bennett, Broussard, Breedbart, and Wiesner in 1982. And this is that you could use pseudo-random functions. Okay, so the bank could, you know, have some pseudo-random function that takes as input a serial number and maps it to like a description of the quantum state that it should prepare for that dollar bill, right? And now the bank doesn't need to have a separate secret for every bill that it runs off. It just needs to have one secret, which is what is this function that maps the serial number to the state of the electrons. Okay, and now, you know, now already we're trading something in terms of security, which is that if someone could distinguish this pseudo-random function from a truly random function, then it's possible that they could break the money scheme, right? But what you can prove is that this scheme is going to be secure unless the pseudo-random function can be broken, right? And the way you can prove that is, well, suppose that someone was able to copy the money, right? Suppose that there was a counterfeiter and they were able to succeed in taking a bill and, you know, creating more identical bills. Okay, well then we know that that wouldn't be possible if the quantum state of the bill were truly random, right? Therefore, the very fact that the counterfeiter can make copies of the bill itself, you know, would be distinguishing this function from a truly random function, okay, thereby breaking the pseudo-random function. Okay, so if, you know, pseudo-randomness is possible, which, you know, we believe in theoretical computer science. We know how to get pseudo-random functions from any one-way function, from any function which is easy to compute but hard to invert. Okay, then, you know, you can do this, and the bank only needs to know one secret. Okay. Now the third problem is maybe, you know, like a more serious one. And this is that the only one that knows how to authenticate the bills is the bank. Okay, so you know, if you want to verify a bill, we said you take it to the bank. All right, well, that's not very convenient. Okay, so there's no quantum analog here of the convenience store clerk holding up a bill to a light. You know, there's no, you know, so what we would like ideally is to have money that only the bank can create, of course, but that anyone can verify. Okay, and so it's really this third problem that we're going to be focusing on in this talk. So this has really been sort of an open problem for 40 years, whether you can have quantum money that anyone can authenticate. And so this brings us to the topic of the talk today, which is it possible to have public, what I'll call public key quantum money? Okay, the name here is, of course, by analogy to public key cryptography. Okay, where, you know, you have what's, you know, might intuitively seem impossible. You have a crypto system where, you know, anyone can encrypt the message, okay, but it's only the intended recipient that knows how to decrypt them, okay. And so, you know, likewise, we want to sort of have money where anyone can authenticate the money, although, you know, only the bank knows how to create it. Okay, so just an overview of the results. So the first set of results is from a paper I had at Conference on Computational Complexity a year ago, and So the first result is we're going to show that if you want this public key quantum money, so you want quantum money that anyone can authenticate, then you can't hope for the kind of unconditional security that Wiesner's scheme gave you. Okay, you have to, you know, in addition to assuming the validity of quantum mechanics and, you know, the, you know, validity of the, you know, no cloning and so forth, also make some computational hardness assumption. Okay, so this is sort of putting one constraint on this money. But all right, fine. You know, we're very used to this, right? In classical computer science, right? We, you know, just, you know, name the problem. You know, we'll come up with some assumption under which, you know, that problem can be solved, right? So. Okay, so you know, so we're very used to, you know, taking things that we don't know how to solve and putting a box around it, and saying this is our assumption is that it can't be solved. But okay, so but now okay, so can we actually construct a public key quantum money scheme? So we're going to get partway there. Okay, so what I proved in this paper is that secure public key quantum money is possible if the counterfeiters only have black box access to the device for checking the money. Okay, so assuming that we can assume that the counterfeiter has stolen the device for checking the money. They've broken into the convenience store at night and they've taken it. Okay. And they can feed this checking device any input that they like, and they can see whether it authenticates that bill or doesn't authenticate it. Okay, but even then, we're going to prove that exponentially many queries to the checking device are going to be needed in order to counterfeit the money. Okay, so now this is a typical move that we make in computer science when we don't know how to prove something. We say, well, assume that the part we don't know how to analyze is a black box. Right, but this part actually turned in the case of quantum money. This turns out to already be non-trivial. It's going to require sort of a new result, which I call the complexity theoretic no-cloning theorem. And you can think of this as sort of a common generalization of two limitation theorems from quantum mechanics. Okay, one of them is the no-cloning theorem, and the other one is the optimality of Grover's algorithm for search. Okay, and we'll see how it generalizes both. And then the third thing I did in this paper is that I stuck my neck out and I proposed an explicit scheme for public key quantum money, which is based on what are called random stabilizer states. Okay, and this is a scheme that doesn't require any sort of black box assumption. Okay, so then the second thing I'll tell you about is a paper, AFGHKLS. This is with all the authors who are listed on the title slide. I'm sorry, I forgot to update it. This was actually in the Innovations in Computer Science conference, which was just earlier this month. And so the first thing we do here is we break my scheme. So incidentally, Avi Natan Hasidim is a postdoc, and David Gossett, Andy Litomirsky, who were students at MIT, came to me and they said, we think we know how to break your scheme. So I did the only thing that seemed reasonable, which was I joined the paper, which was breaking it. So fine, look, I never said I knew it was secure anyway. It was just a question. Okay, so I can be proud at least that this scheme stood for 5 months, which is longer than most of longer than a lot of them. But in any case, it's broken. So then we also came up with some possible new candidate schemes, and actually we've already broken some of those as well. But these new schemes have a very strange property, which is that it's not just that a counterfeiter can't duplicate a bill. Okay, the bank can't duplicate them either. Okay, so the bank can generate the bill, but then you ask it to make that same bill a second time, and it has no idea how to do that. Okay, so that's kind of a curious feature. Not logically necessary, but it somehow seems helpful, and this is part of why this question is so interesting to me. I mean, okay, we don't expect that this is going to have applications in the next certainly not. I think that we'll have practical quantum computers before we have practical quantum money. Okay, because this is like a quantum computer that you have to be able to put in your pocket. Okay, and you have to be able to carry around like cash. But the first thing is, we want to know sort of, at a fundamental level, right, what is it that the laws of physics say about this question? About, are the mints or the counterfeiters eventually going to win? Right, it's a kind of it's a very basic question. And the other thing that interests me is that when you actually try to think about how to construct the quantum money scheme, it really seems just on the verge of being possible, right? So you need states that can't be duplicated, but on the other hand, that can be verified. Okay, so we know the no-cloning theorem, right? But the question is, how far does the no-cloning theorem extend? Does it actually extend to having, you know, quantum states that you can't duplicate, but actually that you can check that, yes, this is the quantum state that I want. Okay, so it's these sort of twin requirements that sort of make quantum money sort of just on the verge of being possible. We still don't know whether it is or not in the real world. Okay, so what we can prove is, first of all, it's possible in the black box world. Second of all, if it's possible in the real world, you're going to need computational assumptions, and we don't yet know what computational assumptions are going to suffice, if any. Okay, but it certainly seems like we're going to have to stick our neck out and you know, make some new assumptions rather than using any of the existing assumptions. Okay, so you know, the security assumption for our new schemes is that they can't be broken. Okay, so you know, theoretical computer science is sort of all about passing blame, right? It's about saying, well, our system is secure unless you can solve this other problem that people have been trying to solve and they couldn't. Okay, but you know, in the case of quantum money, that seemed that kind of you know, these like security reductions to existing problems seem very, very hard to do, because there might in principle be just some way to copy money that doesn't let you sort of solve any computational problem. Okay, certainly we're not going to, you know, base a scheme on the hardness of factoring, because with a, you know, in a world with quantum computers, factoring is easy. But you know, could we base it on some other cryptographic assumption? This we still don't know. Okay, so if there's time, I'll tell you a little bit about a related task, which is quantum software copy protection. So here the question is, you know, can you have this is you might know that making copy protected software is something that is sort of fundamentally impossible in the classical world. Although this is not for lack of trying on the part of software companies, you know, who use all sorts of tricks and devices to make software less convenient to copy. But if you have if your software can be a quantum state, then, you know, this possibility also becomes reopened, right? Because now you could imagine that there's some quantum state that lets you compute some function, but that doesn't let you prepare additional quantum states that would let you compute the same function. Okay, so the question is, you know, is this possible? And if so, for which classes of functions is it possible? Okay, so what we can prove is, again, if you make this assumption of black box adversaries, okay, so you assume that the there's some black box that everyone knows how to evaluate, but you know, no one knows the internal workings of, then quantum copy protection is actually generically possible. Okay, what I mean by that is there are certain classes of functions that are trivial to copy, because you could just figure out from the input-output behavior what it's doing. Like, let's say you knew that your program took as input like a number x, and it just multiplied it by some other number, right? Then just by trial and error, you could tell what that number is, and then there's no way in the world with quantum mechanics or with anything else to make that, you know, make that thing copy protected. Okay, but we can show that except for that one obstruction, you can quantumly copy protect anything in the black box world. Okay, so you can make software such that if there were a way to copy it, then there would also be a way just to learn the function itself from black box access. Okay, and then we also give explicit candidate schemes for copy protecting the family of point functions. Okay, so a point function is just a function which is one at some specific input and which is zero at all the other inputs. Okay, so an example would be a password program. Like, you type in your password and it tells you if it's correct or not, right? Now, what's actually done, like if you use, in Unix, for example, when you type your password, what it does is all the passwords are stored in an encrypted file, right? And now it encrypts your password and it compares that to the encrypted password that's in the file, okay, and sees if they match. But now, if someone got access to the file, right, then they wouldn't actually learn the passwords. They would just, you know, they would have to decrypt it first, right? So, okay, so we can actually do something stronger quantum mechanically. We can get a password checking program where not only can someone not read the password file, they can't even copy the password file. Okay, so if they tried to make their own copy of the password file, then you would see that something had gone wrong. Chris.
Are you talking then about these programs that compute a function that they can do it repeatedly?
Yes, I am. So that's okay. A good point. You can also have programs that you can run once on one input and then they go poof, right? And actually, that could be like a bug, but for some software companies, that might actually be a feature, right? Because then they can just keep selling you this disposable software that you keep having to buy more and more of it. Okay, but it turns out to be a very general point that I was going to get to later, but I can say it now, that if you just bought enough copies of the program from your quantum software store, so you bought like a polynomial number of copies, then you could actually push the error probability down to being exponentially small just by using standard amplification. And as long as the error is exponentially small, there are general principles that say that the damage to the quantum state after each function evaluation will also be exponentially small, right? Which means that then you could run the program on as many inputs as you like. Okay, so this that kind of system where you only where you would get to sell people software that can only run once, and then it would just quantum mechanically collapse, and you'd have to buy more. That only works if you can also restrict how many copies of the program each customer is allowed to buy. Like if you can cut them off after the first few drinks or something, or the first few quantum programs. Okay, so we'll be talking about money that you can verify as many times as you want, and quantum software that you can run as many times as you want, and that's more or less without loss of generality. Okay, so I just had like a formal definition of quantum money schemes here. The details are not that important, but we'll have some N, which is our security parameter. It's basically just the thing that everything else should be polynomial in. Okay, so sort of standard in cryptography, this will basically be like the size of our money, the number of qubits of our money. Everything will be polynomially related to that. Okay. And now we'll have some polynomial-sized quantum circuit, which we call B. It's the bank, which which takes as input a secret key. So S will be the only secret that the bank knows, right? So S is the one thing that only the bank knows and no one else does. Okay, and now using S, the bank circuit needs to be able to generate a public key, E sub S, so something that it can give out to everyone. E sub S is what everyone else uses to verify the money. And then also a quantum banknote, rho sub S. And then we'll also have a polynomial-sized quantum circuit A, which is the authenticator of the money. Okay, and this takes as input a purported banknote, rho, and also a public key E, and then it either measures the quantum money, and then it either accepts or it rejects. Okay. And then, sort of in the standard way in cryptography, we can define the completeness and soundness errors. Okay, so we say that a quantum money scheme has completeness error epsilon if for every possible secret S, the probability basically that the authenticator accepts a valid banknote given a valid public key is large. Okay, is at least 1 minus epsilon. Okay, and so actually one question that comes up is, are we implicitly assuming here that every bill is identical to every other one? Okay, and the answer is we're not, and the reason is because this state, rho sub s, is a mixed state, right? So it's sort of all this formalism already encapsulates the possibility that each banknote has a serial number, right? And this, and the serial number could be different for every bill. In that case, rho sub s would just include a probabilistic mixture of all the different serial numbers. Okay. So the bills can be the same or they can be different. Okay, in most of the actual schemes that we'll deal with, it's convenient to let each bill be different, to let each bill have, in addition to the quantum state, have a classical serial number. Okay, now we say that a quantum money scheme has soundness error delta. Basically, what all this is saying is if it's hard to copy the money. Okay, but you have to translate. In modern cryptography, you have to, you know, take such things and translate them into something more formal. So we say if for every polynomial-sized quantum circuit C, you can think of as the counterfeiter, which would take K legitimate quantum banknotes and would map it to R purported quantum banknotes for some R greater than K, the sum over all I equals 1 to R of the probability that the authenticator accepts the ith banknote is at most K plus delta. Okay, so in other words, you know, you could sort of take these K bills and shift them around however you like among the K registers. You could also do something, you know, a bit more complicated, like you could with half probability, you could put the bills here. With half probability, you could put them over here. So now you have some quantum state that has like part of a bill here, part of a bill here, and you've sort of split it up in some probabilistic or quantum way. Okay, but it's saying you can't take your starting money and generate more money. Okay, you can't, you know, or at least not with more than like an exponentially small chance of succeeding, right? So, you know, this delta should be very small. Okay, so that making, in other words, generating free money should take too long to be feasible. Yeah.
About to depend on R and K.
Oh, that's a good question. So I'll basically say that the way I'm thinking of it, delta should only depend on N. And then, you know, R and K, so everything is polynomial in N. So they sort of, you know, you could sort of write delta as a function of R and K, but I'll just say that R and K are polynomials in N. They have to be, since the counterfeiter is a polynomial time algorithm, right? And then delta should be like less than 1 over P of N for any polynomial P. Okay, so in cryptography, such functions are called negligible. Right? Some people will just write plus negligible. Okay, and what negligible means is less than 1 over polynomial. Okay, so now if the counterfeiter only gets rows of best, then we say that the scheme is private key. This is like Wiesner's scheme. If the counterfeiter gets both rho sub s and e sub s, then the scheme is public key. Okay? And now, you know, our real goal is to come up with a public key scheme where the completeness error, epsilon, and soundness error, delta, are both exponentially small, you know, or like as small as we can make them. Okay, and so this is the question that Chris already asked. Does, you know, well, in the software context, right, does verifying a bill already, like immediately destroy it, right? So if so, you might say that this money is sort of limited use. But actually, in the paper of BBBW in 1982, they noticed this issue. And so then they said, all right, look, if you have money which is destroyed immediately on verification, this could still be useful. And so then they called it subway tokens. Okay, so you know, this is money that you get to drop once into a box, and then, you know, and then it's gone. Okay, so you know, we could consider that kind of money if we wanted. But again, if delta is small enough, then you could prove that you could actually, whatever measurement is made to verify the money, you could uncompute everything except for the final answer of that measurement, right? You could just reverse whatever unitary transformation is performed as part of the verification, and then your quantum state, your quantum money state, will be returned to one, which is extremely close in trace distance to the state that you started with. Okay, so it'll be like only square root of delta away in trace distance, which means that if delta is exponentially small, then you can indeed reuse the money, and you know, you can verify the money, hold it up to the light an exponential number of times. Okay, which, you know, which is way longer than the money in our wallets lasts anyhow. So that's, you know, that's pretty good. Okay, so, you know, after exponential time, we'll all be dead. Okay, so, all right, so the first result that I promised you is that no public key quantum money scheme can be information theoretically secure. Okay, so you can't hope for the kind of security that Wiesner got for his private key scheme. Okay, so a sketch of the proof. So we need to show that if you had a counterfeiter with unlimited computation time, okay, with no limits whatsoever on its computational power, then that such a counterfeiter really could copy the money, okay, you know, in any public key quantum money scheme. Okay, so what's the algorithm? How do they copy the money? Well, this is the algorithm. Okay, so let's So how does it work? So here's what the counterfeiter could do. Okay. So let you be an ensemble of possible quantum money states. Okay. Initially, we're going to put into this ensemble every possible quantum money state. Okay. So we put in rho sub s for every possible secret string s that the bank might have started with. Okay. So and then what we're going to do is we're going to repeatedly use the true authenticator to whittle down our ensemble. We're going to repeatedly throw out the quantum money states that we find are not good, and then we're going to prove that after only a linear number of rounds, we must be left with an ensemble of good money states. Okay, which we can then, since we know what it is and we have unlimited computation time, we can then make as many copies of as we want. Okay, so for t equals 0 to n minus 1, we do the following. We're going to go to the legitimate authenticator. Okay, so we're going to leave our lab, go to the corner store, and hand off our current guess as to what the money should be. Okay, actually, there's a bit of a risk that we're going to get arrested while we're doing this, but maybe we'll go to a different convenience store for each t. Okay, so. So now we try to pass off our money, okay? And if the money gets accepted by the clerk, then we're done. We've solved our problem. We know how to generate money now. We know how to counterfeit. Okay. Otherwise, what we're going to do is we're going to go to the ATM. You have to spend some money before you can print free money. Okay. And we're going to get a legitimate quantum money state, rho sub s star. Okay. And now. We're going to go back to our lab, and we're going to sort of enumerate over all the possible authentication algorithms, and we're going to find an S such that the authenticator A sub S rejects most states in U sub T, but accepts rho sub S star. Okay, now I claim that such an authenticator has to exist. Does anyone see why? Yeah.
So finite time.
Well, this is finite. It's a finite exponential amount of time.
So you didn't win anything, really.
Well, so what?
And you didn't win anything, really.
No. Well, what we're proving is that if the counter, is exactly what's written up at the top, right? That if the counterfeiter has unlimited computation power, then they can copy the money. Okay, so we're proving that the security of the scheme can't be based on quantum mechanics by itself. It also has to be based on computational intractability, which is not obvious a priori, because Wiesner's scheme really was based only on quantum mechanics, not on any computational assumptions. Yeah.
What if you pick delta so that the state dies after e to the root n verifications? Now you still got, you can use it a lot, but
right.
So
then,
breaks.
So then what you do is this amplification trick that I mentioned before. Okay, then you just take like poly of n copies of the money, and then you push down the error to the point where you can redo it. Okay. Questions? Okay. So now I claim that there has to be an authenticator A sub S that rejects most states in U sub T, but accepts rho sub S star. Well, at the least, A sub S star, the true authenticator, will be such a one, right? Because we know by assumption that it does reject most of our current quantum money states, but also by assumption it accepts the true quantum money state. Okay, so we might find, A sub S star, or we might find some other authenticator that has that same property, but in any case, we'll find at least one of them. And then we let U sub T plus 1 be the set of all states in U sub T in our current ensemble that authenticator, A sub S, accepts with high probability. Okay, so now I claim that this whole process is only going to continue for a linear number of rounds. Why is that? Well, because each time we guess an authenticator, a constant fraction of the states that are currently in our ensemble get thrown out by assumption, right? Because otherwise we would have already been done. Okay, so either we're done or else we throw away like 80% of the states that we currently have, right? But this whittling down, this, if you start with 2 to the n states, and in each round, you throw away like 80% of them, then after, L of n rounds, you're going to be left with just a single state, right? You're going to be left with just a single S, okay, which then must be the correct secret that the bank knows. All right, fine. So we have to make computational assumptions. So Okay, so as I mentioned, you know, I was able to get part of the way to doing that. You know, I can do it in the within the black box model, okay, where you assume that the counterfeiter only has black box access to a device for checking the money. So how is that done? Okay, well, the first question you might ask is, doesn't Reasoner's scheme already provide that? And the answer is interesting. Actually, it doesn't. So you remember Reasoner's scheme, you know, where you had like a bunch of polarized electrons, you know, and they're all completely unentangled with each other, right? And you know, and you have that like for each bill. Okay, but now notice that suppose that a counterfeiter had access to a device for checking the money. Imagine that a counterfeiter in, you know, with Reasoner's scheme could submit sample bills and see whether they're valid or not. Okay, then I claim that a counterfeiter actually could copy the money. How would they do it? Well, they could just use the checking device to figure out the state of one qubit at a time. Okay, so they start with a valid bill. They get a valid bill from the ATM. And then they leave the last n minus 1 qubits in the correct states, but then they just rotate around the first qubit. Okay, so they try out all the possible states for the first qubit. They pass each one through the authenticator, and they see, you know, which state of the first qubit will get the authenticator to accept. And then once they know that, then they fix the first qubit in that state. And now they rotate around the second qubit and keep feeding it to the authenticator, you know, until they find the state of the second qubit, you know, and so forth. Okay, so then the counterfeiter will learn actually the classical descriptions of each of these states, and then they can run off as many copies as they want. Okay, so what this says is that if we want a money scheme which is going to be secure against a black box adversary, then we have to do something more, you know, more sophisticated than what Reasoner did. Okay, so so what's our solution to this problem? Okay, so the simplest solution is just if the bank were to choose quantum states or n qubit states uniformly at random from the Haar measure. Okay, so just completely random states. Now, there's a problem even in preparing such states. Okay, and you can replace this by pseudo random states. Okay, that you know, as long as they're sort of sufficiently pseudo random, but. It's, you know, on the other hand, as long as you assume you have these magical black boxes around, you could also just assume that the black box spits out the Haar random state. Okay, so, you know, in any case, let's just consider the case where the bank is able to prepare money states psi, which are just where psi has just been chosen uniformly at random from the Haar measure and then fixed. So then, you know, then each quantum banknote is just a copy of psi. And now what's the checking device going to do? Well, it's just going to accept psi, and it's going to reject every state which is orthogonal to psi. Okay, so you can't have a checking device that's going to accept psi and reject every other state, because there could be a little bit of error, you know, and if the inner product between psi and psi prime is small, and if the checking device accepts psi, then of course it also has to accept psi prime. Okay, but it can at least reject every state which is orthogonal to psi. Okay, now here's the key question. Now, we have to imagine that a counterfeiter has two resources, okay? They have a polynomial number of copies of psi, and they also have a polynomial number of accesses to the checking device. Okay, now using both of those resources together, can they make more money? Can they print free money? That's the question. Okay, well, so now the first thing to notice is that if we were only talking about one of these resources and not the other, then the answer would follow from known results in quantum information theory. Okay, so if the counterfeiter only had k copies of psi and not u, then we would basically be in the situation analyzed by Reasoner 40 years ago, right? And the answer is the counterfeiter can't create more money, basically because of the no cloning theorem, right? You know, you can't. There's no linear quantum operation that maps psi tensor k to psi tensor k plus 1. Okay. Now, on the other hand, suppose that the counterfeiter didn't have any legitimate money to start with. They only had access to the checking device U. Okay, then in principle, they could still figure out what the money is. But, you know, how many accesses to U would it take? Well, you can prove using the fact that Grover's search algorithm is optimal, which was actually proved before Grover's algorithm was discovered. that U has to be queried an exponential number of times. Okay, you get a quadratic improvement over the obvious, you know. Well, first of all, you know, it's not double exponential, right? So you can do a kind of quantum searching procedure, but you know, still that quantum searching procedure will take order 2^n/2 steps in order to converge on psi. Yeah, Robin.
In your solution, you say, fine, choose a state uniformly at random.
Yeah.
What happened to your secret key S?
So you can think of S as just the it's a good question, as just the thing that tells the bank which psi to prepare. Okay, and if psi is pseudo random, then it'll be the description, the preparation procedure for psi.
So to each F, because there's a finite number of S's,
yes,
and to each one of them, we assign a specific quantum state.
Yes.
That is chosen at random.
Yes.
And the counterfeiter doesn't know what that map is.
Exactly. Yes. Well, no, the counterfeiter knows what the map is, but they don't know what S is.
But okay. If they know what the map is, then they don't need to clone our random state. They only need to clone 1/2 possible.
Oh, that's true. So I said that, you know, we should. The simplest case is just that we imagine that S is exponentially large and that the state is R random, right? And now you can replace it by a pseudo random one, but that gets a little bit more complicated.
But that requires your key to be substantially more than n bits, right?
Yes. So yeah, that's true.
Okay.
So okay, but maybe the better way to, you know, imagine it is just imagine that the oracle that authenticates the money can also prepare copies of psi. Okay. Imagine that it prepares copies of psi, but only if you feed it S, only if you feed it the secret S, which only the bank knows. Then the oracle will prepare copies of psi. Okay? You can, you know, it's an oracle. We can define it to do whatever we want. Okay, yeah, Richard.
You mentioned that you can just do it sort of pseudo-random.
Yeah.
Thing, so does that mean S can be a polynomial number of bits?
Yeah. Okay. All right. So now the question is, you know, what if the counterfeiter has both? So they have some copies of psi, and they can also feed the copies to, you know, they can also feed states to you and check if they're good or not. Okay. We saw before that, you know, like in the case of Wiesner's scheme, having both of these things together can often give you the power to copy money that you wouldn't have with either one alone, right? So you know, I realize that this actually requires proving sort of a new kind of quantum lower bound. So I proved something which I call the complexity theoretic no cloning theorem, because it's like a complexity theoretic version of the no cloning theorem. Okay, so what it says is let psi be an n qubit state. Now suppose that you're given k copies of psi, and you're also given a black box U which accepts psi but which rejects all states orthogonal to psi. Okay, then if you want to prepare more states that have significant overlap with psi. So if you want to output R states, call them, you know, it might be mixed in general, row 1 up to row R, such that the sum from I equals 1 up to R of the overlap between row sub I and psi is significantly greater than K, like any, you know, is more than K plus delta, then you need at least this many queries to U. And you can read the bound there, but the important point about it is that it's exponential in n, okay? It's 2^(n/2), you know, and then divided. Okay, so as r and k become larger, the bound becomes weaker, of course, and as delta becomes smaller, it also becomes weaker. But if all these things are polynomial, then the bound is exponential in n, right? Okay, so now how do we prove this? Well, what we do is we take Ambionis's quantum adversary method, right, which is, you know, one of our, you know, our sort of, you know, most powerful ideas for, you know, how to prove limitations of quantum algorithms, right, are one of our most powerful quantum lower bound methods. But now we have to generalize it. Okay, and the hard part about, you know, proving that this problem is hard, right, is that, in some sense, the algorithm starts out at the very first step already knowing the answer. Okay, it's step 0. It's already got k copies of the target state, right? And, you know, and then all, you know, you're trying to show is just that it's hard to, you know, if it wants to make k plus 1 copies of the target state, then this is hard, right? But it somehow it already has all the information, right? You know, and it can already feed the target state into the Oracle and check, indeed, this is the target, the right target state. Okay, so, but the key point fact that we exploit is that if psi is a hard random state, then, like, okay, so, like, look at two different psi's, like a psi and phi, let's say, that have, which are not identical, but also not orthogonal. Like, let's say they have some partial overlap. They're at a 45-degree angle from each other, right? So now if you take the tensor product of k copies of psi, right, then that will have some smaller inner product. It'll be like the inner product to the kth power. But if you take the tensor product of k plus 1 copies, that will have an even smaller inner product. That'll be like the inner product to the k plus first power. Right? So now, so basically, if you're going to copy a quantum state, then you have to be decreasing the inner product between like every possible pair of starting states. Right? So between, you know, every psi and phi, you started out with the inner product being something to the k, and you end with the inner product being something to the k plus 1. Okay, now for any like specific pair of states, you know, there is a way to decrease the inner product in this way, right? You can just push them apart from each other. What we show is that on average you can't do this. Okay, there's no way to query the Oracle U in a way that decreases the inner product significantly for every possible pair of states, right? And therefore, if the states were Haar random, then with high probability, you're not going to be decreasing their inner products. That means that you're not going to be making copies. Okay, at least, you know, or not without a large number of queries. Okay, so I wanted to say a little bit about the explicit candidate schemes, but I'm running out of time, and they were broken anyway. So, you know, we had just quickly, we had one which was based on what are called stabilizer states, a special class of quantum states, you know, the subject of this beautiful Gottesman-Knill theorem. They can be efficiently simulated on a classical computer. They have all sorts of nice properties. And so we use, we create a scheme where the money consists of a bunch of random stabilizer states. And then we also, like, we give a way to measure the states, and then we just give a conventional digital signature of the table and of the measurement table. And now most of the measurements are just completely random, but we have like a tiny fraction of secret measurements that that actually commute with the stabilizer states. And now to verify a bill, we would just apply random measurements and then verify that slightly more than half of them return the right outcomes. Right, so like slightly more than half of them, you know, return the right outcomes, which indeed would be the case if a small fraction of these measurements are chosen to commute with our stabilizer states. Okay, and now the hope is that learning classical descriptions of the states or copying them in any other way would be a computationally intractable problem. Okay, so breaking my scheme, how do we do it? Well, if this epsilon, the fraction of the commuting measurements, is extremely small, then our test is too weak, and we can just guess random states, then they'll pass the test. If epsilon is large, then, you know, we notice that, okay, if two measurements both commute with the state, then in particular, they also commute with each other, right? And therefore, we can consider a graph where there's an edge between two possible measurements, if and only if they commute with each other. Okay, and this will look like a random graph, but it will have some anomalously large click in it. Okay, which is all these measurements that all commute with each other, right? And now, if we could find these measurements that all commute with each other, then we learn what our states are, and that enables us to copy our money, right? Or, you know, to learn how the bank prepared the money, in fact. And now we're able to adapt an unfortunate algorithm due to Alon, Krivolevich, and Sudakov, you know, just a classical algorithm for finding large planted clicks in random graphs. And it sort of works just well enough to break our scheme. You know, it's a non-trivial algorithm, but, you know, but it breaks it. Okay, so our new scheme is basically, you know, you start with like an equal superposition over possible strings. You compute some, like, you know, you sort of make some random measurements of the state, and then whatever those measurement outcomes are, the measurement outcomes are the serial number of your bill. Right, and then the bill itself is just the quantum state that's left over after the measurements. Okay, so now the key point with this kind of scheme is that not even the bank knows what the outcomes of these measurements is going to be. Right, So, you know, the you can, you know, the like you can prepare, the bank knows how to prepare a bill, but it doesn't know which bill it's going to get, right? It'll be a different bill each time, right, depending on the measurement outcomes. And as a result, not even the bank knows how to prepare a second bill that's identical to a bill that it already prepared. Okay, so it's an open problem, you know, you know, whether you can come up with a scheme of this type, whether there's some choice of these measurements, you know, that you would make such that any quantum algorithm would need exponential time to copy the money. You know, and so the interesting point is that unlike with the stabilizer scheme that I talked about before, here there's no obvious classical secret that would let you copy a bill if you could learn it. Okay, so there might be some like inherently quantum copying procedure that would just take a bill and that would do some unitary and output two bills, but there doesn't seem to be any classical secret that if you learned it, you know, would just let you do what the bank is doing, right? Except, you know, the only secret is how the bank is digitally signing the serial number. Okay, that's, you know, and that for that we're just using some conventional classical digital signature scheme. But, you know, other than that, there seems to be no classical secret that would let you copy the money. Okay, so quantum software copy protection. Yes, finally a serious use for quantum computing. I'm going to skip this part. You know, if there's questions, I can tell you about how would you copy protect point functions. This, I should mention, has not been broken, the scheme for copy protecting point functions. And I'm absolutely certain that it's secure. Okay, but all right, so summary, unforgeable money. I mean, I think it remains, you know, and other related things like copy protected software, I think remains one of the most striking potential applications of quantum mechanics to computer science. So we've been revisiting this 40-year-old idea using the arsenal of modern you know, theoretical computer science. The big challenge is to come up with secure quantum money that anyone can verify, not just the bank. So I showed how to achieve this in the black box world. But in the real world, we know we're going to have to need some computational assumptions. And finding a scheme that withstands attack is a lot harder than it looks. I would encourage any of you to try your hand at it. And have, you know, some other open problems here. I think maybe the biggest open problem is, can we just keep a quantum money state coherent for more than a few seconds? So I'll end there. Thank you.
I guess I apologize in advance if this question is a bit rambling, but so let's go back to the pseudo-random money scheme where the bank has a serial number, there's a pseudo-random function that generates a quantum state, and they put that state on the bill. So if instead of generating quantum states, they generated classical states, well, then it's probably easy to break. I just have one copy of each bill, I look at the classical state. If I could only look at the classical states through like a noisy measurement device, then I could still get information about the pseudo-random function. That's like, I measure it and I'd say there's like a 90% probability that this is actually what was on the bill.
Yes.
So if I have a really noisy measurement device, then I couldn't get any information anymore because it would just be giving me back random numbers. So the question is, where on that spectrum does the quantum pseudo-random bill lie? Can I get any information about what's
going on? So you can, information theoretically, sure, you can get some information. I mean, like, you could just measure each state, right, and then just, like, measure each of your qubits in the 0-1 basis, and then 75% of the measurement outcomes will be correct, right? Like, if you happen to have the right basis, then you'll get the right outcome. If it's the wrong basis, then you only get the right answer half the time, you know, then it's random, right? But say you've learned 3/4 of the output bits of the pseudo-random function. But here's the thing. You know, our belief from computational complexity now is that even if you knew all of the bits of the, you know, this of f of, say f sub s of x, where s is the secret key and x is the serial number of the bill, right? Even if you knew every bit of f sub s of x, as well as f sub s of y for some other, you know, serial number y and so on, for, you know, as many serial numbers as you like, still it would take you exponential time to find s, okay, to find the seed of the, which is being used to generate all of these quantum states. Right, and so, you know, that's only a conjecture that's based on the pseudo-random function being secure, right? But then, you know, what you prove is that if you could copy the quantum money, then you really could you know, break the pseudo random function.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right. If I think of a question later, I'll be happy to answer.
So, can you say again what the verification procedure was for this real world?
Which one? The stabilizer money or the?
No, the one the one that you picked up is secure.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. So, so for this, the verification, I mean, even just to construct the polynomial time verification procedure is already non-trivial. It's basically you construct a Markov chain whose stationary distribution is uniform over all of the elements in your superposition that are, you know, that are consistent with the measurement outcomes, right? And so, and then you basically run this Markov chain until it converges, and you you know, you argue that for some choice of parameters, this Markov chain has a 1 over polynomial gap, and it converges in polynomial time. So this is done in this paper. You can see it in this paper. But the real problem is that can we get a setting where this converges in polynomial time, but the thing is also secure, and that we're not sure about.
So I don't understand.
Yeah.
How does this help you verify that psi is the superposition? And if it does, then how come you can't use it to make psi?
Because the key thing that we're let's see. The reason why we can't make psi is that, you know, we could make some equal superposition, right? And now we could measure, but now the chance is only exponentially small if we're going to happen to get the same measurement outcomes that the banks got. Right, we're probably almost certainly, if we try to do it ourselves, we're going to get some other measurement outcomes. So now, you know, what we can do is we can run this Markov chain. I misspoke. So 1 over polynomial gap is bad here. If we had a 1 over polynomial gap, then you really could prepare psi. Okay, so we want the gap to be smaller than that. We want the gap to be smaller, so, you know, and then that's the difficulty. We want it to be, so we can construct a Markov chain that eventually converges to psi, but, you know, we want that to take exponential time. And then, so that way, you know, if you want to... But, you know, on the other hand, if you're already in this stationary state, then you can verify that indeed you are. This is the proposal. It's not obvious at all, as I said, that, you know, that it's going to be possible to satisfy all the requirements here.
So, Scott, this is a classical Markov chain?
Because it's
not. Even if you had an efficient classical Markov chain that converged quickly, right, it still doesn't mean you can use that to prepare an equal superposition.
Right.
I mean, that would be.
Yeah, you don't want it
very powerful.
Right. We want it to be hard to prepare.
But the point is, you take this classical Markov chain and then make it into a quantum block.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm not all classical Markov chains can you do that.
I see. Okay, well then, we could try to find a classical Markov chain where it's hard to turn it into a block.
But there are some that is important that you can't, I think, because if you could.
Then you could solve some hard computational problem.
Yeah.
I see.
You know, I think you're thinking of whether you can create the stationary state rather than you can create the Markov chain.
Create the superposition state.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. If you can do that, then
maybe create this computational
problem. Okay, sure. I'm happy to talk with the first problem.
On the previous page, you started with the superposition, then made some hash measurements.
Yep.
So then you get the possible outcomes of this form an ensemble of states.
Yes.
So the two parts of my question are, first, whether you can comment on what properties that ensemble has contrasted with the stabilizer states, which we understand pretty well.
Right.
The other question is, why do I think you prepared these post-selectively?
Yes.
You seem to be implying that you can't prepare one deterministically.
Well, we don't know.
Could make it again, right?
Right, right. We don't know. Okay. So, well, actually, I think I can answer both questions with the same answer. So the key point and the key difference between this scheme and the stabilizer scheme is that here the preparation of the build, you know, involves making measurements where you don't know in advance what the outcomes are going to be. Okay, so you know you make an equal superposition and then you measure these various observables. Okay, and now whatever the outcomes are, you know, that's going to be your build. Okay, so the stabilizer scheme did not have that property. Okay, with the stabilizer scheme, there was some classical string, you know, which such that given that string, you could then in polynomial time just prepare the state deterministically. Okay, here, you know, at least the preparation procedure that's the obvious one, is a non-deterministic one.
Why do you think there's not a
deterministic? But there's not a deterministic one? Well, you know, we hope there's not. You know, I don't know. Okay, as I said, you know, we don't know how to base the security of these schemes on any existing type of cryptographic assumption. So we're trying to explore the space of possible schemes. But I mean, at least the intuition for it would be that, you get these measurement outcomes, and if you wanted to prepare a state that was, you know, consistent with these outcomes, it seems like, you know, you have to prepare an equal superposition over all strings x such that h1x equals 0, h2x equals 1, h3x equals 1, and so forth. Right, so now in general, that kind of problem we expect to be very hard. If you could solve it in full generality, it would give you a way to solve anti-complete problems, right? You could just say, find me a string that's compatible with all these constraints. You know, that would be solving an anti-complete problem, right? So it would be very surprising, at least, if there were a general quantum algorithm that would prepare a state that's consistent with all of these given constraints. I mean, in fact, you know, if you consider arbitrary types of constraints, that would let you solve QMA problems. Right, so that's the intuition.
So just one last question, so it narrows.
Yeah.
So in this specific situation, you are dealing with money, so it's not anything. So
what?
Yeah, that's money. So
yeah.
Money has a cost.
Yeah.
We know how much is it.
Yeah.
So why to address this problem in terms of a cryptographic problem? Because you don't need absolute security. What you need is, like in a game theoretical situation, that breaking the security cost you exactly the value of what you are trying
creating.
To, So I
right.
think that maybe if you look at the problem from the point of view of a Nash equilibrium,
I'll tell you the difficulty with that proposal. It's hard to theoretically model the cost of something. Okay, so we can try to come up with a scheme where, you know, preparing more money is computationally infeasible, right? And when, in particular, to do a computation that would take, you know, longer than the age of the universe. I think that would cost a lot of money, right? I mean, in fact, you know, you could say that what we're hoping for is a scheme that, you know, we're breaking it costs effectively an infinite amount of money. You just can't do it, right? Now, you could try to come up with a scheme where breaking it, you know, is possible, but, you know, only with an amount of computation that costs more money than the bills that you're trying to get. But the problem with that is that the cost of computing power keeps going down, right? So a scheme might be too expensive to break this year, but then it becomes, you know, economical to break it next year, right? So, and I
it's
think
just inflation.
Yeah, exactly, inflation. You know, is the problem, right? So, we want a scheme, you know, which is secure, you know, not merely assuming economic inflation, but even assuming cosmic inflation.